and welcome to Tech Weekly, the podcast that rounds out the best of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this week I'm mostly jet-lagged from a whirlwind trip to the Tokyo Game Show in Japan, my very first trip to the land of the rising sun. And later on in the podcast, you'll get to hear all about it. Joining me to vet the newsworthy from the Knot are Charles Arthur, fresh from a painful interaction with a London Underground banister.
And we should broken finger.
Hurtful. Yeah, well, you can see pictures of that on the... you look quite looming.
I was coming out of an awards dinner where I was being told I was one of the 50 most influential tech people in Britain, which I assume must have been some day when all the other 3,000 or so were out of the country.
And then you stumbled.
Then I hit the balcony.
Well done.
So the only one with a broken finger as well.
Influential and broken. Yes, anyway. And Bobby Johnson, you are our man in the field in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Yes, I've got to get used to this time difference thing.
Between the three of us, we cover the entire time zone.
We do.
We are the international dateline.
Not including the Pitcairn Islands.
We are the world. We are the children. Anyway, on today's show, it's lots and lots of references. Today, we will also be spying on the computerized brain, demanding answers from mechanical minds at the boundary between artificial and real intelligence in the latest attempt of the Turing test. Apparently, robots are further from world domination than had been previously predicted, which I personally am thankful about. And we'll be quizzing Maria Thomas, the brand new CEO of Etsy, the one-stop trade shop for homemade crafts, about her intentions now that she's taken over the helm. You can expect this, plus the latest news, your views from the blogs, and ever-scintillating discussion on this week's show. Direct to you from Guardian Towers. Keep listening or we'll stick the robots on you. Artificial intelligence is the preserve of science fiction, fantasy, and theoretical academics, at once heralded as the holy grail of evolution, and at the same time its downfall. Popularized in movies from Terminator to AI, and of course Isaac Asimov's seminal series of short stories I, Robot, researchers have grappled with the implications of clever man-machines since the Czechs first coined the term in 1921. It wasn't until Alan Turing made his controversial statement about computer intelligence that a machine could be said to be thinking if its output in a live conversation was indistinguishable from what one would expect a human to come up with that there was a practicable IQ test for silicon brains. And this week, the latest pretenders to the human throne were placed up against their Turing nemesis in an attempt to win the Loebner Prize to see how and whether they were clever enough to rise to the challenge. Rollo Carpenter, an AI software engineer and managing director at iCogno, has won the Loebner Prize twice with his creation Jabberwacky. He joins us now on the line. Welcome, Rollo. Thank you very much for coming along.
Thank you very much. So, unfortunately, I didn't win this year.
Yeah, I was going to ask how you did this year.
Well, I came third and was beaten by two software programs called Eugene and Elbot. Elbot came first.
Well, I actually went to Elbot today because I was intrigued by... who had won this. And I think that it was three out of 12 of the judges were fooled by Elbot.
That's right. Elbot in this test was probably the right winner. And one reason why I believe that is because its strategy, if you like, is to try to control the conversation.
Oh, I see.
Which sort of works out. If the user allows it to happen, then it's pretty easy in that circumstance, or easier anyway, to fool the judge. In a long test, that would tend not to work because patterns would become too repetitive and things like that.
But then it sort of falls into the problem. It's a bit like ringing up these systems where you say your name and your address and it's all computer generated and you think, oh, well, the computer understands me. But actually it's doing nothing of the sort and it's only parsing a very small part of what is possible in terms of conversation, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, there are billions or trillions or, well, nearly infinite numbers of things that people might say. My software is not scripted in that way. It's more of a generalist. It's learnt from millions of people and everything they say, and is choosing the optimal context according to the current conversation. That does mean that it needs more context than just a few lines of conversation. And it also means that in a pure Turing test where people come along and ask nasty questions, it's not necessarily going to do so well. because people may not have fed it that data in the past. It relies on the wisdom of the masses, if you like. So it relies on the things they say.
The Turing test has, of course, been criticized in the past as something too simplistic. And even, you know, what is it? Most programmers would fail the Turing test is something that I've heard regularly.
Indeed. And I think, in fact, that point comes up frequently because people come along and ask these logical questions and expect it to come up with answers. And if it says, sorry, I don't know, or if it says something about the weather or something like that, they put it down as a fail. And yet humans do that regularly or make some comment about not wanting to answer such silly questions. And in my view, that is equally or even more valid.
Rollo, I recall talking to you a few years ago about the development of Jabberwock, and you were saying, I think I recall this correctly, that you were looking to look to the internet for a sort of a new corpus of discussion that you could use to feed into it to see how people interact. Is that right? I mean, and has the internet proved to be a useful corpus?
Well, I think for general chat purposes, yes, it is indeed. That is the internet as filtered by very large numbers of rules, because more than 50% of everything that is said to my program is in fact removed again automatically, largely. But that makes it good at holding fun conversations about this and that, about nothing in particular, less good about answering difficult questions. In a way, you could look at it as a kind of conversational Wikipedia or a chat Wikipedia.
And one of the other things that I recall as being about was that there's frequently people who say, well, I've written an AI bot which can detect people in chat rooms who are paedophiles, who are looking to have, you know, these sorts of conversations. But it occurs to me that if they can't identify sort of, and if they can't interact with standard language, that they're not going to get even within spitting distance of solving that sort of problem.
That's right. In fact, I think those claims were overblown at the time. And I don't think anyone's particularly close to that even now. So,
what types of people do you have on the team that are developing? I know that one of your products now is Joan, who is an artificial video intelligent or artificially intelligent video avatar. What types of people do you have who are on the team who are developing Joan and the other products, the artificial intelligent products?
Joan is developed with another company, which is Intermedia Lab in Norwich. And they're currently creating a new version of her, in fact, so you can look out for a new one in the next month or two. Avatars and voices attached to avatars are probably key to many of the applications that they will be put to for commercial purposes. Not necessarily all, but they put a personal face on an AI and enable a slightly more natural conversation.
Do you think that these systems are improving, and if so, by how much?
I do think they're improving, yes. I think that software such as mine, which is learning from lots of people, stand a good chance of doing better in future and overtaking others because of the simple limitations of the media creation process. One or a handful of designers cannot create enough content to actually really truly understand you know, billions of possible things that might be put to them. And therefore, the only way to handle it is with millions of people doing it. And so there is a big advantage in that approach. It may be that the time isn't quite ripe for that approach to have come to the fore yet, although it did win, you know, 2 years ago.
But isn't it the sort of thing where you could, you know, mimic a really anoraki one where, you know, you say anything to it and it comes back with some sort of answers from Wikipedia, like someone who's just very, very, you know, knowledgeable but extremely boring as well?
It could be. This year, my entry was renamed from Jabberwacky to become Cleverbot. Jabberwacky stays, and it's wacky and fun and entertaining. Cleverbot is meant to be a bit more intelligent. And over time, over the course of the next few years, that site will become ever more clever in more useful ways. It will start doing things like looking up in Wikipedia and answering the kinds of, I suppose, I have traditionally thought of as more boring questions that people do nevertheless want to put to it.
Well, many thanks, Rollo. I do appreciate you coming in, and I hope you are a real person. It's been vetted by the fact that Charles, you've spoken, and Bobby's spoken with you in the past.
Indeed. And occasionally people accuse me of not being when I reply by email.
Well, I consider you for sure a real person. It's very nice to meet you. And you can read all about this story and the story that inspired it at guardian.co.uk/technology. And now here's even more news from you from Bobby.
Last week, thousands of game fans made their way to the Japanese capital for the Tokyo Game Show, where big titles on display included Monster Hunter 3, Street Fighter 4, and White Knight Chronicles. Meanwhile, leading developer Bungie revealed that the forthcoming Halo 3 Recon, the latest in the best-selling franchise, could be the last in the series. Silicon Valley's startup community prepared to batten down the hatches last week after one of the industry's most influential investors said it was ready to take harsh decisions to weather the financial storm. The presentation saw bosses at Sequoia Capital, the company which made billions investing in Apple, PayPal and Google, tell their companies that the good times were over and that it was time to start concentrating on making money. A house in the West Midlands has become the first hydrogen-powered home to be connected to Britain's national grid. The house in Lye, near Stourbridge, is run on hydrogen fuel cells, which should be able to provide 75% of its energy needs. And Google is offering a second chance for those of us who have a tendency to send embarrassing emails while under the influence. The experimental mail goggles feature for Gmail asks emailers to answer a series of short maths problems before it will send the message to its destination.
Thanks very much, Bobby. First, let's take a closer look at what happened last week in Japan at the Tokyo Game Show. I was there, I was on the floor, and I was overwhelmed by the blings and blams. It is literally like a migraine. The whole experience was like a migraine. But there were some key things that I really pulled out of the Tokyo Game Show, which seemed that everybody was talking about. Everyone, whether they were Japanese, or whether they were British, or whether they were American, or whether they were German. Everybody was talking about these things. First of all, Japan recognizes that it cannot be as insular as it has been in the past. And this is something that's very, very important because historically the Japanese games market has very much focused on role-playing games that nobody else in the world can understand. I was walking through the technology sector, Akihabara, and literally there were stores dedicated to franchises that I'd never even heard of. Now, increasingly, the Japanese marketplace is starting to recognize that it needs to look outward because the Japanese consumer is becoming, well, they view games as a commodity, not necessarily something to engage with. So, for example, we would see a reality TV show and we just consume it in the same way that somebody releases yet another game and they consume it. And the content and the quality of the products hasn't necessarily been as up to scratch as in the past. And the consumer's starting to flap around. The other thing that really struck me is that Nintendo utterly, and I mean utterly, dominates the Japanese market to the extent that the PlayStation 3 isn't even a factor. The PlayStation 2 is selling more, and its software is selling more than the PlayStation 3's products. And
sounds like everywhere else in that respect.
Well, to be fair, though, the Japanese market, the people at Sony have explicitly said that they don't want to focus on Japan because they recognize that they're looking at independent producers. Nintendo's selling its wares basically via the hardware, and that's really how it's doing its focus. Whereas Sony is specifically looking at Europe as its marketplace, which I found interesting.
Do we believe that, though? I mean, you know, Sony, it's all very good to say, oh, well, we're not getting any of the market, so we never cared about it anyway. You know, we're looking elsewhere. I mean, the fact that if I've been looking at the right figures, I mean, Microsoft Xboxes are selling higher than PlayStations in Japan at the minute, or at least there's a big struggle between that. I mean, that's not just Sony focusing somewhere else. That's Sony losing its home market, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I would agree with that. But you can see that they're struggling to clutch it back, and they are clutching it back in the handheld market, which is a very, very important space in Japan. The PSP has a product that's called Monster Hunter that really that's literally done nothing in this country. But it is a phenomenon that has apparently single-handedly saved the PSP console.
But this is one of these problems that I'm just trying to think in my head about, you know, exchange rates and things, because I'm trying to think of whether the PlayStation 3 is advantageous for Sony to do well with in the US, and whether it's advantageous to do well with in Europe, or advantageous to do well with in Japan. And you know, given all the currency fluctuations that you're seeing at the moment, Sony should be looking to Japan to sell the PlayStation 3 because the dollar is appreciating because of all the financial ruckus that's going on.
I mean, there's also the other thing with regard to, you know, Sony and Blu-ray. I mean, they've put so much effort into Blu-ray, which as well seems to be having real problems at the minute. You know, I'm walking around shops in America, you know, they're discounting Blu-ray players left, right and centre to try and get people to buy them, even though they beat HD DVD in the format wars. So you kind of got this, the games industry, really interesting and important, and Sony seems to have kind of sidled out of it to concentrate on elsewhere. I wanted to have a quick chat about the stuff from Sequoia, who are, you know, notoriously one of the Valley's kind of most influential venture capital groups, behind Google and many others. But I'm really interested to see how it plays out with them saying, okay, you know, now it's time to prepare yourself and start being profitable. And you kind of look at it, and some of the immediate reaction was like, oh my God, this is a bellwether for what's going on in the industry. Everyone's going to follow suit. At the same time, you just think, wow, how isolated is Silicon Valley if they're only now saying, hang on, we should be trying to make some profit here.
But the point is, I was looking at an analysis by a guy from a hedge fund who was saying that actually in the middle of this decade, short-term interest rates were effectively negative. That is, you could borrow money and it got cheaper. The loan got cheaper the longer you had it. So it was actually effective to take out a loan, build up a company, build up market share as fast as you could and stuff the idea of profit. And then when the loan came due, it was effectively, you know, you'd gone into a negative interest rate. It was cheaper to pay back. So you could look to pay it back one way or another through, you know, getting some venture capital, and they then look to get you onto the market. That's all changed now, and you're not going to see cheap money. You're not going to see money at effectively negative interest rates for, I would guess, the next 5 years or so. So the market really has changed in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's like the, you know, it's like the mortgage market, isn't it, really? You know, money was being handed out so freely that it had become incredibly cheap, and now it turns out that it's not so. But I wonder how it's going to shake down for, you know, for startups, and especially in Europe, where, you know, what's the status of the euro, what's the status of the pound compared to the dollar. I mean, we started to see more investments coming from the US, where, you know, frankly, that's where most of the money is, out into Europe. And whether we're going to see that carry on, I'm pretty sceptical about that one.
I think there's going to be something of a rush to profit by quite a few of the companies here, or at least a renewed focus on doing things that are profitable, cutting out things that's basically a cost. And I think that's going to have quite a lot of implications for the ordinary person in terms especially of cloud computing services. Where is your stuff in the cloud? Do you know that the company where you've got that stuff is still going to be there when you turn the computer on tomorrow?
Well, you can read all about these and also see videos from the Tokyo Game Show floor at guardian.co.uk/technology. Etsy is an internet phenomenon. Bolstered by e-commerce and the trend away from commercially produced products, the crafting movement from jewelers to artists to bakers to fashion designers have found an international marketplace to distribute their wares. The US-based site launched in 2005 with backers from Web2 mainstays Flickr and Delicious, and was, as most of these things are, a labor of love. By 2007, it had sold $27 million worth of goods. And this year, the hype has been ever stronger with rumors that it would bring eBay to its knees. However, it's bringing in some strong arms now to support its army of primarily female crafters. Former National Public Radio VP and general manager and one-time Amazon.com executive Maria Thomas has joined the company as its CEO and is determined, as she said a few weeks ago at the O'Reilly Web 2 conference in New York, to help the crafter community hit the big time. Earlier this year, Business Week named her as one of the most influential people on the web. And Maria, thank you very much for taking time, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, can you give, for the benefit of listeners over here who may not be familiar with Etsy or as familiar as I am, what Etsy is and why you think it's such a success?
Sure. Etsy is an online marketplace primarily for handmade items. That's sort of the practical positioning of Etsy. But I actually think Etsy is tapping into something much larger than just commerce. I think Etsy is about certain values that people hold to be conscious consumers and to live a more purposeful life. I think that Etsy's success is very much tied to tapping into something, tied to buying things with meaning and sort of, we say inside of Etsy, bring heart to commerce.
Well, what's interesting about it is that, Charles, as you said before this interview, that what we're dealing with is handmade merchandise, and that is sort of stark contrast to mass-produced content. And so how does this support itself? I mean, if somebody has, say, a ring or a poster or a piece of, a scarf or whatever, how can it be commercially viable for the people who are trading it to trade via Etsy?
Well, that's a great question. I think that part of what Etsy is all about is trying to help sellers find a way to make a living making things. And just as with other industries, the web provides an opportunity for these small businesses, small crafters and artisans to actually reach a much larger customer base. Of course, this idea isn't totally new. eBay brought the idea of a marketplace to the mass consumer. But I think what is new about Etsy are a couple of things. One, the more narrow focus on the handmade marketplace. And two, the community, the idea that this group of people, artisans, craftspeople, there's sort of already a community in the offline world. And so the technology allows people to connect more quickly, to find customers more quickly, to really tap into networking effects, something that I think holds great promise for Etsy and something that we haven't really fully tapped into yet.
One of the problems that eBay has had as it has grown larger and larger has been that there have been people who, for one reason or another, are not quite playing the game straight. They're sort of basically people who are counterfeiting, offering counterfeit stuff. And one of the real problems has been in trying to police that, that the community is so large that it basically doesn't scale for eBay's sort of policing team to be able to follow things. How is Etsy coping with that? Because I assume you must have similar problems. As any community grows, you get those sorts of problems crop up.
Well, it's an important question, and I think it's one that Etsy is going to have to get much smarter on. I guess I'd make a couple of upfront points. First of all, we're still, in spite of the metrics that I've quoted you, we're still a relatively small enterprise, certainly compared to eBay. But that doesn't make the question any less important. I think we have to learn from both eBay and Amazon, actually. We need to think of Amazon as a marketplace now as well, about planning for the long term and realizing that, these things do require investment and learnings as an organization. We're going to be investing in and learning around the issue of fraud. I think in our case, there are a couple of things to look at. One is, what is handmade? And we are very much inside of Etsy really focusing on what we believe handmade means. And you can take that, it literally, but I think we intend to take it sort of, define it in our own way so that it's not so literal.
What's the definition then?
Oh, I don't think I could give you the definition at the moment. It's something that's a work in progress, but I think it has a lot of different dimensions, including the means of production, probably the volume of production.
Does it have for example to include original? Because I've heard about people selling copies of other people's work. That you find an item on Etsy which is actually a copy of another item on Etsy.
Sure. Well, there's a couple of things there. One is I think there's an opportunity to distinguish between original designs and original works, and I think both are valid. And I think both can fit into handmade. But I think the real point here is that Etsy will need to really define what we mean by handmade and try to work with sellers in the community to keep that as honest as we possibly can.
But wouldn't someone who's put a lot of effort into creating a particular design, who then sees someone else who's not put any effort into creating the design, has just sort of basically looked at their photo and knocked off a copy, perhaps with cheaper materials, wouldn't they perhaps feel a bit offended if Etsy's allowing the listing to continue?
Well, I think that Etsy will, as a venue, do its the best that we possibly can to prevent those sort of things from happening. I think we need to take a look at, for example, the process of how a seller becomes a seller on Etsy. At the moment, you know, we have the great, we sort of have it such that anybody can fairly easily become a seller on Etsy. There are things that we could look at in terms of that process to try to protect sellers from that type of, you know, deceptive behavior. There are a lot of things to look at. I guess I'd like to step back from the question and sort of emphasize that, you know, perspective here. We're still a very young company in the life cycle of things. I'm not looking for an excuse, but again, it's something that we have to look at as a long-term issue, realize that we're not going to solve every problem up front, recognize what the problems are and not bury them, but really try to work on it as something, work with our community on that issue.
Bobby, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I was just going to spin off that really and ask about the changes that have happened from the business side. I mean, you've come in and there have been other people who have come in. Chad Dickerson came in as your CTO, I think, from Yahoo. I'm just wondering what that means and also whether the kind of, you know, the bulking up of the business side of the operation is at odds with the kind of the handmade culture and the small community atmosphere that's built up.
I don't think it's at odds at all. I think it means great things. I think our community wants, you know, the best site that we can possibly deliver and the best tools and, most importantly, you know, the most qualified customers for their items. So I think that that it's incumbent upon Etsy to do all of those things and to help us do those things. We need, you know, some people who have experience doing, you know, working with consumer-facing internet sites and building to scale. So Chad is among the first of what will be probably several hires to really help us look at building to scale and building the best customer experience we can possibly deliver.
What types of things are you going to bring from your background at NPR and Amazon?
Well, from Amazon, I think there are a couple of big lessons. One I've already mentioned, which is really plan for the long term. I was at Amazon from 99 to 2001, and during that time lived through the boom and bust cycle and really have come to admire Jeff Bezos' focus on the long term and willingness to take risks and to fail and to understand that building a lasting business requires those things. I'm actually sitting here right now drinking an iced coffee out of a mug that has the Amazon.com auctions logo on it, which is, of course, no longer. But Amazon, of course, has built its marketplace business so such that today is, I think, about 30% of its sales is coming from that business. So it took a couple of tries for it to work out the right model, but it seems that it's found its way. And I think that's a very important lesson for Etsy. From NPR, I think a number of things. One is sort of the business model question, right? NPR as a nonprofit was under the same pressures as most web-based businesses to support itself and find a way to support itself, but it didn't necessarily have all of the same opportunities that commercial business had. So we had to be clever and work out how we were going to support the business. Also from NPR, I would say a little bit more on the operational side is, you know, getting a great team of people in place to help execute against a vision is ultimately one of the key principles.
And then the last question that I've got is using that experience and taking a look at how Etsy has been, how the community has developed in Etsy, as Bobby was mentioning, you know, you've got the strong community now, you've got these people who are coming with great experience and sort of laying new models on top of the existing community. What do you think, or rather, how do you think that these new models are going to be best applied without disrupting this very strong and passionate community?
When you talk about new models, Alex, are you referring to business models? What are you referring to exactly?
Business models, community models, just the new ways that you're going to be approaching Etsy.
Well, I think that if we speak about new models in the sense of perhaps some of the social networking models, the kind of idea layering web services onto web services kind of thing. I think they fit in quite nicely with Etsy. As I mentioned earlier in this discussion, one of the opportunities that I think Etsy is really yet to realize is to really build a robust kind of person-to-person type of marketplace. By that I mean, you know, right now we have favorites on the site. You can make a list of your favorites. You can share that with others. But if we were really to use some of the existing technology in the marketplace to build that out, one could imagine how interesting that might be. I mean, the nature of our business is that the items on the site are not homogeneous, and so you know, people may come to the site not necessarily knowing even what they're looking for, and it's perhaps a bit more of a browse and discovery experience. And so if you apply concepts of the wisdom of the crowd or microblogging or the notion of person-to-person referrals, I think it becomes very interesting for Etsy.
Excellent, Maria. Thank you very much for your time. And you can join in the crafting fun at Etsy.com. So speaking of the importance of supporting your local community, here's what's been going on in hours on the blogs. Bobby, what's the latest from technology?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, there was the cabinet reshuffle by Gordon Brown, and he brought in a bit of a pal of his, Stephen Carter, to be the kind of the, I think it's the communications and media and technology brief. Now, I was a bit disappointed by that, to be honest. So I asked the readers who they thought should be kind of Britain's top number one geek. And a few answers came in. A few people voted for Tim Berners-Lee, not a bad choice. A few people even went for Stephen Fry. Jack was posted, although Bernie Zed said he should only get the job without the pipe. And my favourite one, though, was Curiously Persistent, who said Moss from the IT crowd, which I think is an inspired choice.
Excellent idea. I think
have you tried turning it off and turning on again?
Oh, don't. That's been my life this week. Over on the games blog, well, I've been hard at work at the Tokyo Game Show throwing several minutes of video coverage from the show floor with interviews with people like Bungie, who make Halo, Hudson, who make a really intriguing game called Job Hunter for the Wii, and Japanese gaming magazine giant Famitsu. Greg and Keith have been very hard at work here. Keith introduced Google's latest foray into the games market. They're about to bring AdSense into games, and not all of our readers are happy about it. And as far as I could tell, none of the readers actually were happy about it. Here's the only comment that we can actually read out on the air that wasn't moderated. From GWX World, he says, just what we need, not only ridiculous pop-ups and ads in our web browsers, but also in our games too. Just what I need after the boss swats me like a fly, an ad by Google in my face. Oh, the humanity. What a world. Charles?
Well, mine's nice one, actually. I wrote about in the newspaper about my 3-year-old child who was born deaf through a genetic defect and had a cochlear implant at the age of 14 months, and 2 years later is able to speak and talk and hear and so on. Cochlear implants are really amazing in terms of the effects they can have on you know, people who are born deaf. And we had a comment, because I did a blog post about, you know, the various technological advances in it, from Del Trailer, who said, I went deaf at 70 and had a cochlear implant 3 years later. One of the greatest things is that I can now hear my own voice so I don't shout. I can hear the nuances in people's voices and hear what people say without looking at their face. I have 22 electrodes. This is sort of the little things that actually activate the auditory nerve, but find 8 is the best because there's a small bone between the cochlea and the hearing nerve. This diffuses the signal, so I prefer fewer signals that are clearer. I scored 98% in a hearing test, and I can hear a pin drop on a hard surface. I live in the hearing world, and the cochlear implant allows me to lead a normal life because environmental sounds are important to someone that grew up in the hearing world.
Wow.
One must be one of our oldest readers.
That's absolutely amazing. And there's a discussion to be had there, actually, between the cultures of the hearing and of the cultures of the deaf. But we can discuss that offline. And if you'd like to discuss that, then please do come over to the blogs, join in our community and converse with us. Go to guardian.co.uk/technology and you can find all of our blogs there. Well, that's it for this week. Many thanks to our guests, Rollo Carpenter and Maria Thomas. Next week, we're talking to Tim O'Reilly, the man who brought Web 2.0 to the masses. Thanks to our regulars, Bobby Johnson and Charles Arthur, and to producer Phil, who's filling in for Scott. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next Tuesday.